Sunday's Super Bowl is getting a lot of media attention. The MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey is the only NFL stadium constructed without public financing. We'll talk about media coverage with the nation's sports reporter, Dave Zirin. The Olympics in Sochi, Russia are receiving a lot of attention also, with most of the focus on Russia's anti-gay laws and security. But what about worker exploitation and the 1,500 families that have been forced to leave their homes? We'll talk about it with the Washington Post's Kathy Lally. She's in Sochi. And freelance journalist Lucy Jordan joins us to talk about protests against the World Cup in Brazil. Join us after the news.
BBC News with Mike Cooper. The UN mediator Lakhdar Brahimi says the first round of peace talks in Syria in Geneva has had a very modest beginning, but one that can be built on. Mr. Brahimi said the gaps between the government and opposition remained wide, but there were some grounds for reaching a solution. The two Syrian delegations have blamed each other for the lack of progress. James Robbins reports from Geneva.
After 8 days of talks, there has been neither a breakthrough nor a breakdown. Lakhdar Brahimi, the veteran UN mediator, said at least the warring parties got used to sitting in the same room and listening to each other, even if they're still not talking directly, but only through him. Mr. Brahimi conceded that for Syrians trapped in the war, the work in Geneva would seem far too slow.
I understand that, and they are right. But we are trying to overcome the very difficult issues that have led to this war and made it worse almost by the day. And this, unfortunately, takes time.
Mr. Brahimi said there had also been no breakthrough on the desperate humanitarian crisis in Syria.
The UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Valerie Amos says she's disappointed that the two delegations at the Syrian peace talks couldn't agree on humanitarian pauses in the fighting. She said people were dying needlessly while discussions continued. Syrian activists say nearly 2,000 people have been killed since the summit started. Ukrainian police are in a standoff with opposition activists at a hospital where a protest leader, who says he was kidnapped and tortured, is being treated. The opposition fear Dmitry Bulatov will be detained as a warrant has been issued for his arrest. Duncan Crawford reports from the hospital in Kiev where Mr. Bulatov is being treated.
There is a huge group of people outside a hospital because inside there is an anti-government demonstrator. His name is Dmytro Bulatov, and he had actually gone missing earlier this week for 8 days. He appeared last night and said that he had been abducted, beaten up and tortured. He was being cared for in this hospital. The police arrived earlier on today, though, and tried to detain him, but the hospital have refused to allow it to happen. There is now a standoff. Friends of his are there. The doctors and nurses are there, and also opposition figures have arrived, and no one at the moment knows what's going to happen next.
Many mosques in Egypt have delivered a one-theme sermon chosen by the government as part of new controls on Muslim places of worship. The topic of the sermon was the importance of redeveloping squatter settlements. Egyptian officials consider the guidance necessary to stop preachers from stirring political tension. But opponents say the measure is aimed at clerics who are critical of the military-backed government following the overthrow of the Islamist president Mohamed Morsi last year. Militants have killed 15 Yemeni soldiers in an attack on a military checkpoint in the southern province of Hadramaut. Officials have blamed the attack on the jihadist Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. World News from the BBC. Italian police have recovered a piece of cloth soaked with the blood of the late Pope John Paul II, which was stolen last week. More from David Willey in Rome.
Two suspected thieves, both known drug addicts, have been arrested in connection with the crime. Police say they found the small piece of blood-stained cloth in the garage of their house. The cloth fragment came from a cassock worn by the late Pope when a gunman tried to kill him in St. Peter's Square in 1981. Pope John Paul is due to be canonized, made a saint of the Catholic Church, at a ceremony in Rome in April.
The medical charity MSF says 240 of its staff have been forced to flee into the bush in South Sudan because of continuing insecurity. Médecins Sans Frontières said the staff were among thousands of people trying to escape fighting in Unity State, one of the areas worst affected by the conflict between government forces and rebels. Hundreds of rare reptiles and amphibians from Madagascar have been found dead at Johannesburg's international airport. Inspectors found two crates containing 1,600 creatures destined for pet shops in the United States. It's thought they'd gone without food or water for more than 5 days. Richard Hamilton reports.
Many of the animals are listed as endangered under a section of the International Treaty CITES, meaning that they can be traded but with a special permit. It's understood the company transporting them did have that documentation, but charges of animal cruelty are being considered. The creatures were reportedly packed together so tightly that they couldn't move. More than 300 have died, and vets from Johannesburg Zoo are trying to save the others.
There's been outrage in Tanzania over the decision by MPs to award themselves $100,000 each. Residents of Dar es Salaam told the BBC they were shocked at the bonuses, having been told the government had no money to spend on social services. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Sunday, more than 100 million people are expected to watch the Super Bowl, which takes place at the MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey. The MetLife Stadium is the only NFL stadium constructed without public financing. It's also the most expensive stadium ever built, costing $1.6 billion. According to Policy Mike, of the 27 NFL stadiums constructed since 1995, a whopping 22 of them were at least 67% funded using taxpayer money. The average stadium was 71% publicly financed during this period, and 8 were entirely taxpayer funded. The NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, earns almost $30 million a year. Joining us to talk about the economics of the Super Bowl and stadiums is Dave Zirin. He's the nation's sports correspondent and author of several books, including Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you. And the Olympics in Sochi, Russia is receiving widespread media attention, with most of the focus on security and anti-gay laws. The most expensive Olympics in history, expected to cost between $50 and $60 billion. That's billion with a B. But what's not receiving much attention is worker exploitation and displacement. According to the Washington Post's Kathy Lally, about 500 companies and 96,000 workers are laboring in a city of 345,000. She reports that construction roars along 24 hours a day, leaving some residents dazed. Others are protesting. All are weary of the pounding of jackhammers and the clouds of dust. Many of the construction workers are migrants, especially from Central Asia, and they get miserable wages, and sometimes they're not paid at all. That's according to a Human Rights Watch report issued this month. Kathy Lally is the Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Uh-oh.
Was that Kathy? So Kathy is in Sochi, Russia, and she said that the internet connection is really bad there and she might have some problems with her cell connection. So we will hopefully reconnect with her. And thousands of people are taking to the streets in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, to protest the mounting cost of hosting the World Cup. That is expected to cost $15 billion. Lucy Jordan is a freelance journalist based in Brazil. She's contributed to the New York Times, Global Post, and The Independent. Hi, Lucy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So let's start with you, Dave. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, something I thought that was absolutely important. Hopefully listeners will be aware of the story that was on Grantland's website about a week ago. It was pretty horrific, about a woman who... a trans woman who was outed as part of the story. She invented a golf club, and the story ends with her taking her own life. And it was written so callously, it got both the trans community and allies of the trans community up in arms, because, frankly, it was written without even the slightest nod to any sort of respectable journalistic conduct or respect for this woman's privacy. The Arizona Republic, a terrific reporter named Megan Finnerty, did an article about the partner of Dr. Vanderbilt, the woman who took her own life, the woman who was left behind, interviewed her and got an actual three-dimensional story and didn't turn her into the worst and ugliest, most transphobic kind of caricature. And the article called "Friend Blames Timing of Gilbert Inventor's Suicide on Fear of Impending Article." And Megan Finnerty did a wonderful job. It's a terrific story. Arizona Republic, terrific newspaper writing. People should check it out.
Wow. I hadn't heard of this. Is this getting a lot of attention now?
A huge story because Grantland had to issue multiple apologies for it. The editors had to issue multiple apologies. They've been slammed by fellow ESPN employees. Their ombudsman issued a blistering report. It just shocked people that it was printed so callously, that the story was written in a first-person narrative. The late Dr. S.A. Vanderbilt was outed by the reporter to one of her investors. That's written so casually in the article. And, I mean, things that are just egregious breaches of good journalistic practices in the Society of Professional Journalists guidelines are just throughout the article.
Wow. Well, we'll definitely link to that after the show. And we did a show about the trans community and just the fight for transgender rights on Monday. So if you missed that, be sure to tune into that. Thanks, Dave. And I think we have Kathy Lally now on the line from Sochi, Russia. Hi, Kathy. Are you with us? Hello, Kathy.
Yes, I am.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. I'm glad we got you. So, Kathy, I understand that the cell reception isn't so great in Sochi, Russia right now.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? The line is a little bit.
I understand that the cell reception isn't so great in Sochi, Russia right now.
At this point, the workers have all been sent out of Sochi. Many of them were turned away, according to the human rights workers who have been defending them. And after all the work and all,
you know, I'm sorry, Kathy, we've got a bad line. We're going to have to call you back. We're trying to reach Kathy Lally in Sochi, Russia. Dave, you know what's fascinating about this? We were emailing Kathy last night, and she basically said, I'll hope to join you, but the cell reception is bad. And then this morning she wrote us and said, the internet connection is really bad. And it's kind of strange because this is happening, you know, in a place where it's costing they're spending $50 billion on the Olympics.
Yeah, $50 billion being a low estimate at this point. I'll tell you, though, one good thing about having Kathy on from Sochi is that it increases your audience, because the Russian state has already said publicly that they'll be listening in to all reporters' phone calls and correspondence.
Really?
So you'll get a little bump in the ratings.
Well, I mean, what does this say? $50 billion, and I mean, they're building, you know, new lamp posts, because apparently in this area they don't have very good lighting, but they're not going to turn the lamp posts on until the Olympics start.
Yeah, I really want to be clear about this, especially for your audience, because I know what I can just hear what some of them might be thinking right now, which is, pointing out Russia? Why are we singling them out? Aren't all Olympics corrupt? Don't all Olympics have budget overruns? Why the attack on Russia? And I want to be very clear for your audience. Yes, it's true that all Olympics have cost overruns. Yes, it's true that there's cronyism and corruption at every Olympics and every World Cup, for that matter. But the scale of corruption in Sochi is unlike anything we have seen in the sordid history of the Olympic Games. It will cost more than every single Winter Olympics combined, and it will go down as the most expensive Olympics in history, even though historically the Winter Games are always less expensive than the Summer Games.
Lucy, the World Cup in Brazil is expected to cost about $15 billion. Have there been many articles written about corruption?
When a few years ago the sports minister, I believe, was ousted for whiffs of corruption, and that was some years ago when Brazil was still trying to bid on the World Cup and the Olympics. But recently, it's not been so corruption directly involved with the budget so much as just the extraordinary amount being spent when basic services are underfunded. That's really what people are focusing on.
Where is the money coming from, specifically in Brazil and the World Cup? Again, $15 billion.
I don't have the exact breakdown, but it's a mixture of public funding and public-private partnerships. But a lot of it is, you know, they have said to some private partnerships, okay, you can build here, but then FIFA is also putting these exclusion, 2 kilometer exclusion zones around the stadiums, which will be very advantageous to the private businesses involved, because they will be able to control what vendors are there and that kind of thing. So the exact breakdown of the funding, I don't have right in front of me right now. I apologize for that. But it is a mixture of public and private funding.
And thousands of people have taken to the streets. The BBC had a piece a couple days ago saying that about 128 people have been detained so far. What are people saying on the streets about the World Cup?
Yeah, there were 135 people detained in Sao Paulo on Saturday night alone, and one man was actually shot by the military police. People are still angry. The amount of rage is less than it was in June. June was really when the streets were swept by about a million people at one point with complaints about the World Cup and the Olympics and overspending on the Confederations Cup and the visit of the Pope, and most of the population is Catholic, so that I think is testimony to people's rage at this. But at the moment, there have been sporadic protests since then, and they will probably continue to pop up, but they've been on a much smaller scale. There will be protests during the World Cup. I think that much is inevitable.
And in articles, people are quoted talking about corruption, police brutality, dire public services. They talk about comparing the World Cup's price to what the state spends on education, for example. They talk about street crime.
Yes, yeah. And police brutality has been a big factor in encouraging these protests. A lot of protesters say that the reason they became so enraged initially was because of the reaction of the police in repressing quite violently the first quite small protest over the hike in bus ticket prices in Sao Paulo back in June. Police put that down quite aggressively and were violent towards the members of the public and members of the press as well, and that's when it really all kicked off. I mean, Brazil's police force is famously quite aggressive and the military police and violent. I mean, I think one NGO estimated that they were causing at one point as many as five deaths per day, the military police. So that's a bit of an indicator as to the reputation that the military police have here.
How is this being covered in Brazil?
It's being covered a lot, and the protests. Initially, the media was one of the targets in June because some of the protesters felt that Globo in particular, which is the most powerful media conglomerate, had given a rather pro-government spin on them. But since then, Globo have changed their tune, and the other main newspapers and smaller outlets have really been covering it very thoroughly and giving a lot of space to the protesters' views.
Dave, the FIFA secretary, the Football Association Federation Secretary General Jerome Valcke, basically spoke the truth in a recent press conference in April. He said, quote, less democracy is sometimes better for organizing a World Cup.
Yeah, that's something that he has said at repeated events. At one event where he said it with a shrug of the shoulders after academics and historians produced papers showing that the 1934 World Cup, which was held in Italy under the auspices of Mussolini, and the 1978 World Cup held in Argentina under the watchful eye of the brutal General Videla dictatorship, both of which were fixed for Italy and Argentina to win for the purposes of their own national glory. And afterwards, the gentleman you mentioned, Valcke, he gave a speech. And he sort of shrugged his shoulders and he said, you know what, it's like democracy is great and all, but one thing you have to say about those authoritarian societies, they got things done on time. And for FIFA, that it's their currency is control. Their currency is not soccer, their currency is not money, their currency is control. And anything that affects their control, whether it's people protesting in the streets, whether it's construction workers who refuse to go on the job because the conditions are so unsafe, whether it's soccer players threatening to unionize, all of these things, you'll hear FIFA say the most retrograde, reactionary things you could possibly imagine, and frankly, do it without shame.
And when we hear that these events cost so much money, Lucy, we also hear that, well, this will become a major destination for tourism, in the case of Sochi for sure, but also we're going to bring in so much money to the communities. I mean, we hear this over and over again. How is that playing out in Brazil?
Well, what you have to understand about the process of hosting these mega cups, mega events in Brazil, is that it's causing more than 100,000 people to lose their homes. I think the latest estimate by activists is a conservative estimate of 170,000 people that will be evicted to make way for developments related to the World Cup. And just going back to what Dave said, FIFA is denying, FIFA is saying that not one single eviction can be linked to World Cup stadiums. And this is simply not really true. You know, there are in every single host city you can link evictions to developments. So I understand that tourism will increase because of this, but there's a big human cost for the in Brazil, especially for the country themselves. People are being evicted to make way not just for stadiums, not just for the World Cup village, but for the Olympic village, but for widening of roads and for increased transport systems and beautification of waterfronts and all these things that happen. I was speaking to Teresa Williamson recently, and she's the executive director for Catalytic Communities and founded Rio on Watch, which has been tracking these evictions. And the way she put it was that mega events like this create a state of exception. And within these states of exception, municipalities, because of the deadlines, because of the budget, because of the pressure, they are pretty much allowed to do whatever they like within that time frame, and they just get the legal aspects of it completely bypassed. So they take advantage to push through gentrification agendas, which have been which they haven't been able to do before because of pesky legislation.
And 1,500 families are being displaced in Sochi, Russia. The ones that are being, quote, allowed to stay have been asked to repaint their homes, and in many cases they say they can't afford the paint. It's not being given to them. And Dave, you know, in many cases this also exposes the lack of infrastructure and services in these areas, because the government has to spend a lot of money on basic things like roads, electricity, and water. I mean, in the case of Sochi, they're building these new lamps because there's so little light at night.
Yeah, no, that's true. And also, let's not forget also that Sochi is a subtropical climate. I mean, I think a lot of people hear Russia and think snow, but that is not all of Russia. It's a huge country. Sochi is a place where most famously Joseph Stalin would go to sun himself in between, I guess, purges. It's just worth people to know that Russia got this bid for these Olympics precisely for what you said, because they were willing to spend this amount of money. And in Putin's presentation to the IOC, for see, the IOC is a bombastic organization. The bigger, the better. And, of course, the bigger, the better also means the more opportunities for corruption, which I think we'd be naive to think is also a point of attraction. So if you go to the IOC and you say something like, hey, I live in a northern climate, we have snow, we have mountains, we have infrastructure set up, we even have a little village from the last time we hosted the Olympics 30 years ago, that's not attractive to the IOC. But if you come in like Putin did and you say, this is literally what he said. He said, I am going to remake a subtropical climate and redevelop it dramatically. And not only am I going to remake it, but I'm also going to do it in an area that's been near a war zone, basically, the Chechen Wars, which have been going on for 20 years and killed 160,000 people have lost their lives over the course of 20 years. It's that kind of arrogance that just makes the IOC drool. And I want one of the stories that you see peeking out right now is the number of people in the Western media who seem to me to be just waking up right now to the fact that they're going somewhere that is not only going to be the site of a ton of corruption and klepto kleptocapitalism, but also a place that might be very dangerous for themselves. Mm.
Well, and according to Kathy Lally's piece in the Washington Post, Sochi is being transformed not only by stadiums and ski jumps, but also new roads, 22 tunnels, train stations, miles of railroad tracks, high-rise apartments, new sidewalks, construction of 8 power plants, and a new grid system to replace a now precarious supply of electricity. And then there's also major environmental aspects to this. According to reports, 5,000 acres of formerly pristine forest, home to rare species like Caucasian wingnut trees and Black Sea salmon, have been lost. And Earth First is reporting that environmental activists are just being shut out, and there's a major crackdown in Russia on environmental activism. Have you been reading about that, Dave?
Oh, I thought you were flipping it back to Sochi. Yeah, absolutely. No, the environmental activism is very strong. Also, the Circassian minority that has used to live in Sochi, that's been subject to all sorts of repression, activism, and agitation around that issue, has been very strong as well. And then there's the issue also of workplace rights. The last number I saw was 25 people who had been killed in workplace accidents in just the building of Sochi. I mean, those numbers are actually in line with previous Olympics, but it speaks to just the level of infrastructure that they've had to put together for Sochi, and the families that have been displaced as well. So there's no shortage of activism. Unfortunately, the response by Vladimir Putin has been to say, well, we will erect a pen 7.5 miles away from where everything with the Olympics is going on, and anybody who wants to protest can go in that pen. This is going to sound familiar, I think, to a lot of U.S. activists. And if they come any closer than the pen, then they will be subject to arrest.
And I should mention that we were trying to get Kathy Lally in Sochi, Russia, but it's just her line is so bad. And, you know, she told us this might be an issue because the infrastructure there is just not up to par. But I guess they say that when the Olympics starts, they're going to have all these new lights. And you have to think that they've got to have really good cell phone action once the Olympics starts, right, Dave?
I mean, you would think so. I mean, it's a media event. It's also a media event where the IOC holds the rights, I mean, just furiously. So, which is why people may have wondered, like, why in this day and age, it's like you can watch on NBC, but if you try to see the highlights on ESPN, all you see are still photos. Because the footage itself is just held very, very tightly. And so it really depends on, I mean, it's kind of old-fashioned in a way. It's kind of like nice old media. Like, you need boots on the ground. You need people actually describing what has taken place. So any problems with Wi-Fi service, any problems with communications ability, I mean, talk about, that's one of the few things that would make the IOC, and not to mention its broadcast partner, NBC, extremely nervous for these Olympics. Mm-hmm.
And Lucy, there have been reports so far, 2 workers have died at the World Cup Stadium construction site in Sao Paulo. What is the status of workers there? And we'll talk later about what's going on in Sochi. A lot of them said that they haven't even been paid.
Two men died at the Sao Paulo site, and 2 have also died in Manaus, and 1 in Brasilia as well, in the capital. So I believe it's a total of 5 so far at the moment. There have been complaints that they're being made to work hours beyond their contracts, you know, backed about shifts to try and get things done, because these stadiums are well behind schedule, as I'm sure you know. We just heard yesterday that the stadium in Porto Alegre in the south of Brazil, it was supposed to have its opening match this weekend, but that's not going to be possible because the infrastructure work hasn't been finished yet. In Cuiabá, I don't even know if they've got the roof on yet. I think there are some serious delays. At least 5 are still under construction of the 12 stadiums, and they were supposed to be ready by December 31st.
And Lucy, before we let you go, what is the responsibility of the media to expose this? I mean, as so many journalists will, you know, go to these games, and there's so many angles to take. But what about this angle that's not really getting that much attention?
Of construction or of the workers?
Well, just the worker exploitation, the amount of money that's being spent.
Mm. Well, I think that it's tough in Brazil. It's not a very transparent society. It's getting more transparent. The government is trying to pass freedom of information laws, but it's traditionally very difficult to expose corruption in terms of costs and so on, because, and it's traditionally a very corrupt society. I mean, I have no doubt that there is an immense amount of corruption going on with these constructions. There's probably a lot of overbilling happening. So it is difficult to find that kind of thing out when it's difficult to get hold of any documents or from companies and from government agencies. But I think the media are doing an okay job. The Brazilian media, I think they're doing a good job, and we'll just have to monitor it to see when the actual details of costs come out, when all the money's been spent, how much it actually costs in the end.
Lucy, can you stick around with us? We have one caller who wants to ask you a question right after the break.
Sure thing.
Okay, great. This is your call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call here on KALW. A program that relies on engaged listeners, we invite you to join today's conversation. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. Toll free 866-798-8255. Or if you'd rather write, you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find all of the links related to today's weekly media roundtable. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about what we know about suicide. We'll also talk about why the rates are rising. Suicide rates among middle-aged Americans have risen sharply in the past decade. So what explains this? Every year, more than 38,000 Americans take their lives. We'll talk about warning signs and what can be done to prevent suicide. That's Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. We're talking about sports today. On Sunday, more than 100 million people are expected to watch the Super Bowl. It's taking place at the MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey. It's the most expensive stadium ever built, costing $1.6 billion, the only NFL stadium constructed without public financing. And we'll talk about that a little later in the show. We're also talking about the Olympics in Sochi, Russia, the most expensive Olympics in history, costing $50 to $60 billion. And we're talking about coverage of worker exploitation, displacement, the environment, and we're also talking about the World Cup. That's costing $15 billion. We're joined by Lucy Jordan, a freelance journalist based in Brazil, and Dave Zirin, the nation's sports correspondent. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on how these events are being covered? They're getting widespread media attention. Are you reading much about these angles? The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a very good program, as usual. My question has to do with Brazil and the fact that Dilma Rousseff has just announced the importation of thousands of Cuban doctors to help out with the healthcare situation in Brazil. Is it in response to the widespread demonstrations that took place in Brazil? I'll take your answer of the year. Thank you again.
Thank you. Lucy, do you know?
Yes, it was in response to that. As you'll know, one of the main complaints of protesters was that basic services such as education and especially health are very poor in Brazil. You will have seen the posters that people held during the protest saying, "We want FIFA standard hospitals, we want FIFA standard schools," referring to the fact that existing stadiums had to be raised and rebuilt to get them up to the standard that FIFA demanded for the World Cup, and billions of dollars is being spent to do this. So, yes, the problem is that with doctors in Brazil is that a lot of them are concentrated around the coastal areas and the south southeast around Rio and Sao Paulo. And where Brazil lacks doctors is in the poorer interior. So the aim of this more doctors program, as it's called, is to get doctors where they're needed into more isolated communities in the poorer inside parts of Brazil's states. And that program has been successful for Dilma. Her popularity has gone up since that. It shelved very suddenly after the protests, but since then she's gone back up to a personal approval rating of about 58%. And she's looking in good shape for the election in October.
This got widespread attention in the middle of last year. The Washington Post reports thousands of Cubans are heading to a relatively affluent Brazil to shore up a decrepit healthcare system that has become a national embarrassment. 2 months after mass protests, the president signed a deal to bring 4,000 Cubans by the end of the year to serve for 3 years. And the article says that so far it's been successful, like you just said.
Yeah, and so successful that they're bringing another 2,500 in over the next few months. Yes, they come to Brasilia. They do about 3 weeks of language training in Brasilia, and then they get sent off to their post. And so far, it has been successful. I will personally be interested to see how many requests for asylum come out of it, because I know that that's what happened with a similar program in Venezuela. So I'll be watching out for that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lucy. We'd love to have you back.
It was great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That is Lucy Jordan. She's a freelance journalist based in Brazil. She's contributed to the New York Times, Global Post, and The Independent. Again, the World Cup is expected to cost $15 billion. Thousands of people are taking to the streets to protest the cost, and hundreds have been arrested, just about 300. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And Dave, we're still having problems getting Kathy Lally. I mean, this is sort of part of the story about Sochi, Russia, though, that we can't get a journalist on the ground there. I mean, I guess we'll have to get her when the Olympics starts, because then we expect the phone lines to work.
Yeah, you expect the phone lines to work. I mean, no one knows what is or what isn't going to work. I mean, I think this Olympics is going to be a target by numerous fronts. I mean, there's a lot in the press about Chechen rebels, what are being described as the Black Widows. These are the women whose husbands or sons or fathers were killed by first Boris Yeltsin and then a series of Russian leaders in the Chechen wars. Like I said, 160,000 people losing their lives over this time. There have been bombings recently. But don't forget that Vladimir Putin also has a lot of enemies in the Russian government. You don't know what's going to work and what's not or why. I mean, it's an act of profound hubris to hold an Olympics in a subtropical zone amidst a war zone, an active war. And it's also an act of profound greed by the IOC to say, hey, this is the place we want to be.
Yeah, what was their justification behind this? And did any of these issues come up during that process?
Well, no, I mean, the justification, remember, these things get decided years in advance, and the way that this was decided was that at the time, the Russian economy was absolutely humming with particularly oil money, and Vladimir Putin made what I think can only be described as a mafia offer, you know, the kind of thing where he just put a ton of money on the table to the IOC, and he laid out the plans. I mean, keep in mind, just to give people some perspective, one road, one stinking road, going from the Olympic Village to the top of the mountain where the skiing is going to take place will cost more than the entire Vancouver Olympics of 2010, which was also, by the way, over budget. That is insane. One economist figured out that this particular road, which is going to cost $8.7 billion, if they had chosen to pave the road with 1 centimeter of beluga caviar, it would have cost less than $8.7 billion.
So I know there's so much corruption involved, but is there any way to explain where this money is actually coming from?
Oh, where it's coming from? Sure. That's actually kind of interesting because most of the time when there are budget overruns, the rules are it comes directly from the state. So the previous guest was speaking about the public-private partnerships in Brazil, for example. Well, the way that works is that there's a set budget that's 50-50 between the public sphere and the private sphere, the corporate underwriters. And when that money goes over budget, though, the public, and it always goes over budget, by the way, the public side is responsible for the cost overruns. Now, in this case, in Russia, what's deviated from that a little bit is because the economy has been set up in such an egregiously kind of crypto crony capitalist model, Vladimir Putin is both having the Russian state fund these massive cost overruns, and keep in mind we're talking about $30 billion in cost overruns, and also he's put the strong arm to several of his friends who are some of the leading billionaire industrialists to pony up their own money to make up for some of these shortfalls as well, because it's been in a lot of these folks' companies where a lot of the graft and corruption has taken place. And this is extremely embarrassing to Putin. So one of the ways he's mitigated this, and frankly this has helped him with his local popularity, is by saying, like, yeah, there's corruption, but guess what? The rich are going to pay for their own corruption.
Hmm. Well, and before we move to the Super Bowl, I just want to, again, point out a few stats from the Human Rights Watch report that recently came out. They found that workers from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan make $1.80 to $2.60 an hour on Olympic construction sites, earning between $455 to $605 a month. They're lucky if they've been paid. Interviews with 66 migrants produced consistent descriptions of 12-hour workdays with only one day off in 2 weeks.
Utterly unsurprising. This is how they do. And the situation in Brazil, I mean, it's so interesting. I got to tell you, it's no matter what. I've been now studying all the Olympics, and since the 36, ironically, that the turning point is the 36 Olympics in Hitler's Germany, because you know we associate that so as you know as being this horrible event, you know, the Hitler Olympics. Yet that Olympics was really the turning point, where the Olympics went from this kind of aristocratic athletic festival to the nationalism and the bombast and the marching athletes and just frankly the ceremony and the production, more akin to a kind of a Broadway show than athletics, with all the opening ceremony and the running of the torch. And when I've studied these Olympics, it's what's so crazy, Rose, is that the countries change. The workers exploited change, the currency changes, yet the stories are profoundly similar wherever they go. And one of the things that speaks to is that the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, has really morphed into being this kind of stateless actor. I mean, it already has a non-voting seat at the United Nations, which is bizarre enough if you think about it. And one of the things that they do is they impose their will on a country, and a country then has to conform to what the IOC wants.
Well, it's also so surreal because, again, 1,500 families have been forced to leave, and according to the Washington Post, residents of the remaining 30 or so houses feel trapped. They get home by traveling along roads deeply rutted by heavy equipment, dodging bulldozers along a landscape filled with mountains of dirt and gravel. A row of blooming mimosas reminds them of what used to be marshland, where they could hear frogs croaking instead of engines roaring. Now empty beer bottles discarded by construction workers sprout where flowers once grew. One man, Alexander Dadze, who lived in a modest home for 64 years, says, "It's hard to understand what's going on. They took the land from many people and never gave anything in return." Dave, is it naive of me to think, like, Billie Jean King was on Fresh Air this morning with Terry Gross, and she was talking about going to Sochi, Russia. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many celebrities and high-profile people go to the Olympics. Have any of them spoken out about these issues?
Oh, of course. Yeah, the main issue that people are speaking out on, of course, is the LGBT issue.
Right.
I mean, that's why Billie Jean King was selected by the Obama administration to be one of the people to go. But as far as like the issues of corruption, I mean that's something that you've heard much less of from athletes themselves.
Or worker exploitation.
Or worker exploitation. I mean, if you're asking for well-known athletes, for athletes who your listeners would have heard of, who to speak out about it, you don't hear it. I mean, there are athletes who maybe they wouldn't have heard of. Like, there's a 2006 loser named Samantha Rattrosi, who has a brilliant article at The Nation magazine called How the Olympics Are Like the Hunger Games, where she speaks about all these issues. And Samantha is not a very well-known Olympian. She was a loser in 2006. She's best known for having a horrific crash that was repeated over and over again that's almost like a disaster pornography. You know, it's like people watch it over and don't realize like the pain that she went through in the years afterwards. And her words are absolutely searing. And yet, even her, though, it's like I've been in contact with her. I'm an editor at The Nation. I helped solicit her piece. The amount of pushback that she has gotten, like private harassment from people inside the Olympic movement, inside the United States Olympic Committee, I mean, would put your hair on end. And so there's an element of internal policing that goes on, even for athletes who do object to these issues. And it's interesting to me that they've allowed a little more oxygen around the issue of LGBT rights. I mean, not least of all, because LGBT athletes have been such a critical part of, in particular, the Winter Games, let alone the Olympics themselves. Yet, when it comes to these issues that really speak to the pocketbook, the corruption, the dollars and cents, there's much more silence.
That is Dave Zirin. He is The Nation's sports correspondent and author of several books, including Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. And on today's Media Roundtable, we're talking about media coverage of the Olympics, the World Cup, and the Super Bowl, which is this Sunday. It's taking place at the MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What strikes you about all of the media attention these games are getting? Are you hearing much about the angle that we've decided to take on today's show? And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about the Super Bowl. Whenever you come on the show, we talk a lot about how these stadiums are funded and the salaries of, for example, the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell. It's almost $30 million a year. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about this MetLife Stadium, it's the most expensive stadium, costing $1.6 billion, but the only NFL stadium constructed without public financing. So where did the money come from to build this stadium?
Well, that's a good question. I think we might need a congressional inquiry to find out where it came from. I mean, first of all, we can get deceived sometimes when we talk about public and private financing for these games. For the stadiums themselves. I mean, this particular stadium, to improve it, New Jersey taxpayers put in $400 million, according to the New York Times. So, I mean, that was needed on top of everything else, $400 million. And not to mention the fact that there are a series of special tax breaks, not to mention the fact that they have nonprofit status, believe it or not, like official nonprofit status, the teams themselves, and that goes into whatever they have to put into the stadium construction. I mean, this is just one of the things about professional sports, is that given the amount of public money that goes into these teams, given the amount of subsidies, given the amount of with which the stadiums are underwritten, the absence of public accountability and the absence of ability of the public to actually see the, not just the public, but the players' unions as well, to actually see the books, see where the money's spent, see how many profits are actually there, I mean, is one of the great, I think, one of the great scandals of our time.
So what is it like to try to get this information?
It's like having your tongue caught in a door. I mean, there's It's impossible. It's like because you put in the request, and they immediately are shielded by this antitrust protection they have from the government. And you know, and I've made media efforts to try to get in touch with this. Think about people in Congress, like renegade Congress people, and there are not a lot of them, but renegade Congress people who've tried to find this information have been stonewalled. I mean, the politicians down in Miami, the ownership of the Miami Marlins, looked at them right in the face and said that the team was losing so much money that they would have to move if the Miami Marlins didn't get a new stadium. Well, there was a WikiLeaks-type situation where someone at the team anonymously leaked how much money the team was actually making. And they were, even though they had a terrible team and had no attendance, they were pulling in $40 million-plus in profit a year. And they just looked right at the city council and basically lied right in their face under oath. There were no repercussions for that. They didn't get brought up on, you know, on perjury charges or anything of the sort. There's just an utter contempt that they have for the public, even though it's the public's money that goes into their stadiums.
These organizations enjoy about $1 billion per year in tax favors. Taxpayers have shelled out almost $19 billion in NFL subsidies since 1986. This is according to Policy Mike. Why do you think we don't see much outrage about this in the United States when we see so many protests in other parts of the world over similar issues?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think we should be clear that, like, you really, I mean, what happened in Brazil last year was really unprecedented. I mean, the building of the biggest protests in three decades since the end of the dictatorship in Brazil, taking place with the stadiums becoming the focus of discontent, something that nationalized the discontent in the country. That was very new. In most places, you've seen things like in South Africa, there were big protests that happened after the World Cup, to use that example. But it was more because the bill was due, and the public sector workers, 1.3 million, went out on strike. The idea of protesting stadiums as they're built, you don't see it in the same kind of way. You don't see it with the ferocity, and you don't see it with the anger. And, I mean, a lot of people have different theories why that's the case. I mean, I'll tell you my personal theory. Is I just think that we're screwed over so much in this country with our tax dollars. I mean, think about your typical tax dollar, how much of it goes to the military, how much of it goes to servicing the debt that's already been paid. I think a lot of people look at stadiums and say, well, at the very least, it creates some jobs. At the very least, it provides some entertainment. At the very least, it's tangible. It's something that you can actually see and touch. And you don't really get that from your tax dollar in many other cases. And I think sometimes that's enough to assuage people. And then you've got, you know, people like us and people like KLW who point out, well, wait a minute, you know, are we even getting anything back for our tax dollar? Wouldn't we be better off if we just threw our money in the street and let people pick it up and spend it? Which is actually economically true. That would be more economically sound to just throw your money in the air and let people spend it locally than to build a stadium. But I think that that's why it tends to be the sort of thing that people can be at peace with. And I'd like to see that change, and hopefully in the future we will.
And while the MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey, was constructed without public financing, the city did donate valuable land for the construction of the training facilities for the Giants and the Jets. And then the other thing is, we talked about this earlier, but whenever these games come to town, there's so many promises for the local community. And the NFL is claiming that the Super Bowl will bring $550 million to the region.
Let's be clear about that number. That number is so utterly unverified. And the more it's repeated, the more people think it's actually true. I mean, I actually heard these sports, you know what's the crazy thing is that you know where it's repeated more than anywhere else is on sports radio. As if these folks are economists or something like that. I mean, it's so terrible. I mean, one of the things that you have is like I was listening to a sports radio show last night, Rosa, and they were talking about the fact that Santa Clara, in your neck of the woods, is going to be hosting the 50th Super Bowl the year after next. And your lovely, I believe he's Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom,
right,
was on the show. And there, I mean, it almost sounded like let's just say it sounded very Freudian because they were talking about like $600 million in NYC. Can we get to $1 billion in the Bay Area? Is it possible? It's like, who's got the bigger stick here? And Gavin Newsom was just like, oh, I think we can do it. I think we can get to $1 billion. And I'm just listening to this thinking, like, none of this is true. Well, none of this is true. Economists, the ones who actually do the work, not sports radio hosts, say that these things are money losers in the long run precisely because one-off events do not make for good economics.
What happens when you challenge these numbers? Or do most people do? Is there much challenging going on when these numbers come out?
But that's the thing. I mean, first of all, you have to be in a position to challenge them. And I certainly have been on sports shows where I've had the opportunity to challenge them, but it tends to be viewed as opinion, which is pretty maddening, I have to say, because we're talking about facts. We're talking about economists who have crunched the numbers and figured out how much gets brought in, how much doesn't brought in. I mean, if we want to have a discussion about opinion, like a principled discussion about opinion, then the discussion needs to be about, you know, what does it do for the morale of the region and how does it make people feel? And, you know, and we can have a real discussion about that. But if we're going to have like a real discussion about did this bring in $600 million, you can't say, well, it's my opinion it does. It's not true.
Well, Andrew Zimbalist, a Smith College sports economist, told the Star-Ledger that the estimate is based on false science. He says you should take the NFL numbers and move the decimal point over one space, and then you get a more reasonable number. So instead of $500 million, think more like $50 million. Yeah. Does anybody do much reporting after the games to find out how much actually was how much did actually go into the economy?
Yeah, I mean, you do have people who do that kind of work. I mean, the problem, though, is that sports media is very, very forward-looking. And that's the kindest way I'm going to put it. So it's like if you're doing an article about what was missed, for example, you're not going to get very far. If you're doing an article about what could be missed going forward, you're more likely to get a buzz and get some sound about that. I mean, unfortunately, what usually happens is that it takes some sort of disaster that focuses the public's attention to get people to think about it. Like, for example, the most productive discussions, this is a tragedy that I have to say this, but the most productive discussions that I ever got in about stadium financing in the United States was after Hurricane Katrina, by far. Mm. I mean, because you had a situation where the only stable place for tens of thousands of homeless people in New Orleans to be able to go was the stadium, which had been given hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidies. So there's no emergency shelter, there's no emergency evacuation, but you have the Superdome, which had been given all this money, and of course, let us remember, was completely incapable for human inhabitation within hours of people being inside.
We have a question about the TV ads. So the TV ads, 30-second TV ads during the Super Bowl are costing $4 million.
Mm-hmm.
And the one for SodaStream is getting a lot of attention. SodaStream turns water into sparkling water and soda. And Cornelius sent an email saying the ads on the Super Bowl always become a big story. Do you, Dave, have anything to say about the Scarlett Johansson ad for SodaStream? And just a little background. We only have about a minute and a half.
Oh, no, I'll be very quick about it. I mean, SodaStream is made on an illegal settlement in the West Bank. It's something that, according to international law, should not even be something that's sold, and yet it's sold throughout the United States. And Scarlett Johansson, who's also an international spokesperson for Oxfam, just broke ties with Oxfam and chose instead to be the international brand ambassador for SodaStream. And I have chosen to never watch a Scarlett Johansson movie again. See, we all get to make choices.
Yeah. Well, and this is getting massive media attention. What do you think about the attention?
Well, I think it's because of celebrity. I mean, and the fact that Scarlett Johansson is at the heart of this. Because I got to tell you, like, SodaStream was a Super Bowl ad last year. I talked about it on an MSNBC show. Nobody knew what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. Nobody had heard that this was happening. Nobody knew about SodaStream. Nobody knew about its connection. So this is like something that Scarlett Johansson has focused people's attention on it. Now, one irony here, you talk about her being the brand ambassador, is that as of our conversation right now, Rose, the commercial is not going to air. Not because the Super Bowl has any sort of moral objection to how SodaStream makes products under conditions of military occupation in the occupied West Bank, but because there's a throwaway line making fun of Coke and Pepsi, and that violates the brand agreements for commercials that play on the Super Bowl.
Are you watching the game on Sunday, Dave?
I am, but I'm going to, the first 24 minutes, I'm going to live tweet a very special episode of The Facts of Life. That's my form of protest.
Okay. Dave Zirin.
And it's going to be the one where they all get high on marijuana because both teams are from places.
That's right. Dave Zirin is the nation's sports correspondent and author of several books, including Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. As always, Dave, thanks so much for joining us.
My privilege. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What do we know about suicide, and why are the rates rising? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the underlying factors of suicide. According to the Centers for Disease Control, every year, more than 38,000 Americans take their own lives. Suicide rates among middle-aged Americans have risen sharply in the past decade. What explains this? What are the warning signs, and what can be done to prevent suicide? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALD. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.